The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Ritika Singh. In this episode, Bruce Riedel, director of the Intelligence Project at Brookings, hosted Matt Apuzzo, a reporter at the Associated Press, for a discussion of his new book. Matt and his colleague, Adam Goldman, reported extensively on the NYPD's secret surveillance of American Muslims and won a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting last year. The pair recently published a new book entitled Enemies Within, Inside the NYPD's Secret Spying Unit and Bin Laden's Final Plot Against America. The book is about the 2009 plot to attack the New York City subway system led by Afghan-American Najibullah Zazi. During this conversation, Matt provided details of the plot and discussed the recent claims by NSA and government officials that the NSA surveillance programs directly led to thwarting this terrorist attack.
Welcome to the Brookings Institution, and good morning on a rainy Washington day. Those of you who are furloughed government employees, we are very glad to give you something to do. This is the fourth in a series of talks and discussions sponsored by the Brookings Intelligence Project. The Brookings Intelligence Project likes to focus on intelligence successes and try to explain why intelligence can be successful. And I'm glad to say today that we are looking at one of the most important. You can't hear me?
No. Yes.
There's about seats now. Open in the front. I promise not to call on you.
Right. We welcome people to come down to the front. We won't call on you. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. What we're going to be talking about today is one of the most important terrorist plots planned against the United States in the last decade, perhaps the single most important Al-Qaeda plot planned against the United States in the last decade involving the use of American citizens. It was intended to take place on the 8th anniversary of September 11th in September 2009, and in many ways the plot was a success. It was only at the last minute that the United States authorities were able to detect it and then foil it. It is a classic example of intelligence and counterterrorism success in the post-9/11 world. I'm very glad to have today as our guest Matt Apuzzo, who is the co-author of a book about the plot entitled Enemies Within, Inside the NYPD's Secret Spying Unit and Bin Laden's Final Plot Against America. This is not technically a book event. We don't do those at Brookings, but we are going to talk about the book. I highly recommend it, not just because it really gets you inside this plot, because it is superbly well written. Matt and his co-author Adam Goldman have taken a real-life story and turned it into a heart-stopping fictional account in some ways. It's not fiction, of course, but it comes across like a Tom Clancy novel in some places, and we'll talk about that, and particularly the chase scene, literally, across the United States. It is an important event in another sense as well, because, as we'll soon see, the key piece of information that uncovered the plot came from the National Security Agency, and we'll talk about the NSA surveillance systems and their role in this plot. You have in front of you a piece of paper with Matt's biography, his background. He's a Pulitzer-winning journalist. He and Adam have uncovered many, many significant stories over the years. And as I say, they are both very, very good writers. He's a graduate of Colby College in Maine, and I'm very pleased to have him here today to talk about the book. I'd like to start with the plot.
Yeah.
Could you tell us who Najib Ulazazi was, who his Confederates were, and what they had in mind?
Sure. You know, Najib Ulazazi was a 24-year-old guy when this all unfolded. He's born in Afghanistan, spent a lot of time in his very early years in a Pakistan refugee camp. His father ultimately got a visa to come to the United States and was working, you know, 20-hour days as a cab driver, was able to bring his family over to the United States. They were living in Queens. It was really an immigrant, you know, an immigrant story. They were very pro-America. Even after 9/11, you know, Zazi was very supportive of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. He didn't do so hot in high school. Dropped out of high school. Kind of became disenchanted with the system. He was a coffee cart vendor down on Wall Street, but it was something of a conflicted soul at that moment. You know, he still had like an I Love USA sticker on his coffee cart and, was very chatty, very friendly with all of the, with all of his regulars. He knew what their daily orders were and he chatted them up. Around 2008, he started to get convinced that the United States was, you know, they were an occupying force in Afghanistan, and became kind of persuaded that, that they were no better than the Soviets, and, you know, that there was too many civilian casualties, and that we were going to be there forever. He started going online, and this was not a particularly religious guy, but he started listening to people like Anwar al-Awlaki. A lot of these sort of radical sermons online that were sort of less about sort of, you know, religion at that point, that, you know, and more about, politics, became, I would say, more fringe, more radical in his religious belief. But he was never that religious to begin with. And he and two friends decided that they were going to go and fight with the Taliban, and they were going to go out to Afghanistan, and they were going to join up with the Taliban brigade. And one of these guys, he's Adis Mujahideen, who's of Bosnian descent, he says, I'm going to be a Taliban general. And this, you know, these delusions of grandeur, right? So I'm going to be a Taliban general. So how do you get with the Taliban? You get on an airplane. His dad drove these. Their dad drove them to the airport, and they flew to Pakistan, and they went to visit Zazi's family in Peshawar, and they kind of just made their way out into the frontier, kind of these, you know, accidental tourists, kind of being like, hey, do you know how I could get with the Taliban? Does anybody know how I can get with the Taliban? And at this moment, you know, the United States was just getting the idea that that you didn't need some special, there wasn't some super special pipeline that, you know, terrorist groups had to get you in. They were just coming to grips with the idea that you could actually do this. You could just sort of end up in the frontier and finagle your way into a terrorist group. As it happened, Zazi and his buddies fell into Al-Qaeda. Literally, they fell into Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda said, you know, you don't want to go to the Taliban. I mean, come on, we've got plenty of guys who can go take, you know, take artillery shells for a cause. You know, you guys have American passports, right? I mean, you have stamps. You know, you have stamps to get into the United States. You're not on any list. You got here somehow. And they took him out to a terrorist camp. And we have these scenes in the book of how you get to a terrorist camp where they sort of drive you around and you don't know where you're going and they move you to another car and they leave you at a house and you think that you're sort of left for dead and then another car shows up and they move you somewhere else. And he ends up out near Miram Shah and in a Al-Qaeda sort of walled training camp. I mean, it's literally one of those training camps. You see the B-roll video of the guys doing the monkey bars. And they end up getting trained by some of Al-Qaeda's top guys. The most important is the head of external operations, Saleh al-Somali. Basically, the job Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had at one point. You know, bin Laden's one of his most trusted guys, ends up training these guys on how to make bombs and how to, you know, how to do small weapons and says, and there's a long period of time there where these guys still want to go and fight. They do not want to go off and carry off a mission. And this idea that they're going to become suicide bombers, they're like, we didn't sign up for this. And there's like a lot of back and forth. And they're like, can we even say no? Can you say no to Al-Qaeda? Thanks, but no thanks. We appreciate your time here. Thank you for the tea. But we've decided against your cause. But ultimately, they are persuaded to become suicide bombers, which is a really, I mean, that in and of itself is this incredible thing that three guys who did not want to do that were persuaded to do it, and the moment for Zazi, and this is literally just a confluence of events. He happens to be out in Miram Shah out in the tribal areas at a time when literally when the United States drone policy is changing and we're pushing deeper into Pakistan and we've made a decision to step up strikes and it was a turning point in the drone war and it just literally just so happened that's the month that Zazi was there and became convinced, this is a fight I need to take. This is a fight I need to take up. So it's this sort of, you know, the backdrop to this is how do these guys, right. how do you become an Al-Qaeda suicide bomber? Right. You know, when a week earlier you were at in a coffee cart in Queens thinking that you didn't want to be a suicide bomber.
There's another Al-Qaeda figure in addition to Somali who you highlight in the book, Rashid Rauf.
Right.
Could you give us a little bit of his CV?
He's dead now. Something fell out of the sky. Rashid Rauf and al-Somali have this sort of walk-on roles in this caper. And they are the influencers. They are his teachers, his mentors. They sit around the floor in Miram Shah at this camp and they just, hey, okay, yeah, I get it. You don't want to be a suicide bomber. That's cool. But like, if you were a suicide bomber, like let's say you were a suicide bomber, where would be a good place to hit? You know, tell us about America. Where would be an important place to hit? And they say, Walmart would be a good place to hit. And they say, yeah, okay, yeah, Walmart. All right. Good. What else you got? Like, what else would be a good place to hit? And it just sort of got them into this sort of kibitzing almost about, you know, I know you don't want to be a suicide bomber, but let's just say hypothetically you guys were suicide bombers. So they had this like incredibly influential mentor role here. And I'm certainly not an expert on Rauf's, you know, long history of with Al-Qaeda. But, we get into it, you know, in the book. But what's so great about this case is it really provides you a glimpse into not how people are radicalized online, because I think we've seen a lot of that, and there is a consistent story there. But to be able to see how bin Laden's people, like the people who he trusted, core guys who can track their pedigree back to the origins of Al-Qaeda, how they see, you know, the recruitment process go, how they see the indoctrination process go. So we spend a lot of time on that.
So they, under this recruiting technique, they agree. And what is, in the end, the plot that they've come up with?
So Al-Qaeda says, you guys pick. And I think that's significant because, you know, you can think from a counterterrorism standpoint, if you were to catch one of these guys who's in the room, you wouldn't know, right? I mean, these guys wouldn't know what the plot was. I mean, they said, you guys pick what the plot is. You guys pick your own target. And they also were all using fake names. So, you know, from a counterintelligence, sort of from an operational security standpoint, you can see it was only after they came home that they realized they were talking to Rashid Rauf and that they were talking to Saleh al-Somali. So, I mean, and those guys maybe didn't even know their real names because the three guys from New York were told in the very beginning, here are your fake
right.
names.
Right.
So they're told, go home and pick a plot. And so they go back to Queens and they're playing basketball out at the park near their homes in Flushing. And they're just on the basketball court talking about places they might want to blow up. And they decide that they will make a TATP backpack bomb, three of them, and that the three of them will get on three separate New York City subway trains at rush hour and blow them up as they're leaving, as in the underground tunnels. Three guys, three backpack bombs, three separate trains, rush hour in New York City.
You describe in the book, I'll just read a short excerpt, what would have happened. The initial blast from a backpack bomb would kill anyone standing nearby, but the worst damage would come milliseconds later. The train would be permeated by speeding shrapnel, ball bearings, shards of metal from the subway car, plastic from shredded seats. Survivors would have to grope toward safety through billows of toxic smoke, past mangled bodies, and jagged debris in darkened tunnels. A pretty horrific image. And of course, that's exactly what Al-Qaeda had done in London and had done in Madrid before. So it was a plot that, had it worked, would have probably changed the course of American history. These three guys go to Pakistan. Somehow they find Al-Qaeda. It's good to know that there isn't a kiosk at the airport that says, if you're looking for Al-Qaeda, sign up for the tour here, that it's a little more complicated than that.
But only a little bit, right? I mean, you can just sort of be like, I'm looking for Al-Qaeda.
And there's no reason to believe, it's humorous, but there's also another angle. There seems to be no reason to believe that the Pakistani authorities, the Pakistani state, the Pakistani Inter-Service Intelligence Directorate, sees anything unusual going on here, or if they do, they never told anybody in the United States.
No, in fact, there's no evidence of that. And we saw, shortly before this plot, we saw the Brian Neal Vinnis plot, you know, where not a plot, but where this guy from New York also does basically the same thing, just goes out and ends up getting recruited and ends up becoming part of be part of an inner circle out there. And that ended up, you know, being some good work, collaboration with the Pakistani authorities and the CIA and NSA. So, I mean, we didn't see anything in our research that suggested that there was any knowledge that these guys were out there, knowledge by ISI or anybody out there.
And nobody in the American intelligence community or the FBI or the New York City Police Department or anyone seems to notice that these three guys have gone off to North Waziristan, the heart of darkness, a kind of strange place to go for your tourist expedition.
I mean, he had family. I mean, they had family out there. I mean, then they had cover stories. I mean, they had cover stories that that one of them was going to go and was going to marry Zazi. They were going to introduce Zorain Akhmazeh, one of the guys, to Zazi's cousin, and they were going to try to get him married. And so, I mean, there was a whole – they had a cover story, and they were asked, right? I mean, they were asked at – at the airport. Why are you here? Why are you going? What's the purpose of your trip? And they were asked on their way back. But their stories held up. I mean, you know, think about the number of people in this country who have relatives and family in places that we might say is the heart of darkness, right? I mean, for them, it's going home to visit family, and the vast majority of those trips are innocent.
So they come back, and NSA intercepts something.
Sure. So what happens is they're on the basketball court, and Zazi decides, so I need a place I can go and make these bombs and kind of get off the radar, go out, get off the grid, and blow things up and figure out, you know, how everything's going to go. And he moves. At that time, his uncle and his aunt lived in Aurora, Colorado, just outside Denver. And so he went out there and was working as a shuttle bus driver at the airport, and was working on these recipes, these TATP recipes that they had given him out in Miriam Shaw. And what Zazi had done is he had written up in his notebook how to build these bombs, and then he'd gone and taken pictures of his notebook, and from a internet cafe in Pakistan had emailed himself, just created a Hotmail account and emailed himself the images, so that he didn't have to carry the notebook, you know, back in the United States. So as he's doing this, he gets the primary charge, the primary explosive, the TATP. He makes that. He's successful in making that, and we have a whole scene about the process in which he goes through to avoid detection and making that. So he gets that primary explosive made, but he's unclear about how to go from the next step, you know, to take the next step and get him in the backpack and like the what's going to be the secondary explosion. And it's a combination of flour and this clarified butter called ghee. And so he's confused, and he can't read his own writing. And so he emails this, you know, he has an email address for a go-between out in Pakistan. And he says, hey, the marriage is ready. But I need to understand. And he just says, I need to understand the numbers, flour and ghee. Please get back to me as fast as you can. The marriage is ready. As it turns out, months earlier, completely unrelated to this, there was a FBI MI5/MI6 operation going on in England, called Operation Pathway, in which they took down a bunch of guys there who were interacting with Al-Qaeda. They took them down pre-plot. Operation Pathway is infamous or famous for one of the cabinet secretaries in London is photographed walking into a cabinet briefing, and it says Operation Pathway on like the documents, like as he's walking in, and it has like the names of everybody that's going to get arrested, and it's on the photo as he's walking in. And so they had to take down the plot early. But what happened is, in the course of conducting the searches on that computer, the Brits were actually able to identify this address, sanapektana@yahoo.com, which is the same go-between, the same intermediary that Zazi was emailing. So for the past, you know, 5 months, GCHQ, NSA, I mean, at this point, one and the same, are up on this email address, this Yahoo email address that's in Pakistan. And then when Zazi sends his email saying the marriage is ready, I mean, come on, 9/11 was the big wedding, right? I mean, so right. It didn't take, this was not a gigantic analytical leap.
Right.
And at that point it was, you know, wait a minute, IP address in Colorado? There was this whole, you know, NSA gave it to CIA and CIA gave it to FBI, and then FBI sort of passed it out through the Joint Terrorism Task Force. But there was a lot of confusion. I mean, you know, when we get into this in the book, being like, wait a minute. Like, are you sure that this isn't, like, routed through somewhere? I mean, IP addresses can get routed. This doesn't make any sense. Aurora, Colorado, this guy's not on anybody's radar screen. And so that's the moment. I mean, at that point, that's the moment of when they realize, I think, there's a guy in the United States making contact with Al-Qaeda.
So we have suspect number one in Colorado, and the other two are back in New York. One of the very best parts of the book is the chase. Any really good crime novel has the chase scene. Can you, in some parts of the chase, it's a little bit Keystone Cops, too.
Yeah, what I love about this story is, and what attracted to us to write the book, right, is it's not, it isn't, you know, the sort of like, and it all worked out perfectly, right? I mean, there's all sorts of human moments in this. It begins when Zazie rents a car one night, and the FBI is watching him at this point in Colorado, but they have no idea what they're looking at, right? I mean, there's this guy, all I know is that he sent this email to an Al-Qaeda middleman, don't know really what his deal is. And then, so he wakes up in the morning, he rents a car at night, wakes up in the morning, gets in the car at like 5 a.m, and then hops on the highway, literally 90 to 100 miles an hour, heading east. And at this point, this is like a Colorado issue. They're talking to the guys at FBI headquarters in Washington, but they still don't really know who else is involved, what else is going on. But they're like, okay, well, he's moving now. But we don't want to just stop him, because if we stop him and arrest him for sending the email or pull him in for questioning, then whoever else, and we know at this point that he's gone to Pakistan, and like really quickly, they're able to tell who he's sitting next to on the plane. Okay, he went through secondary with those two guys. You know, I can look through his phone records and decide it looks like he's talking to him. And so they think there are other people, so they don't want to just stop him. So they have a Colorado State Trooper pull him over for speeding. But they don't tell the Colorado State Trooper, like, what's going on. Obviously, just say, you know, hey, should you have cause to stop this guy for speeding, that would be a wonderful thing. We'd really love to know where he's going. And so this corporal stops this guy for speeding in this tiny little frontier town called Lyman, Colorado. And they're standing there by the highway, and the corporal says, where are you headed in such a rush? And he's like, well, I'm going to New York City. And so once that happens, I mean, it's like it's flipped the switch, and the entire machinery goes, you know, into full swing. And they then have to chase him across. He's driving to New York City from Colorado at 100 miles an hour. And so they are now following him, and we talk about how you do the following and the handoff, and they've got airplanes following him. So it is a mad dash across the country at 100 miles an hour with the goal of, like, we got to unravel this plot before he can get here, but under no circumstances are we to allow – we assume he has a bomb, which he did. Under no circumstances are we allow this to get into New York City.
And then is the – of course, anyone who's driven from Colorado at 100 miles an hour nonstop – to New York, then has to confront the classic question, which bridge or tunnel are you going to use to enter the city?
So you can imagine the Joint Terrorism Task Force, these NYPD and FBI guys sitting around, and they know this guy's coming, and they, you know, they can see it, and they're sitting around and they're saying, okay, freshman algebra. A car leaves Aurora, Colorado at 100 miles an hour, right? Assuming 2 hours, you know, of sleep at a rest stop outside, you know, Dayton, you know, Ohio. At what point does he enter? And it's, well, what, he'll be in traffic at this point, and we need to be. And so it's literally that. Like, it's that moment going on. It is literally, come on, guys, calculators. So they decide, and I'm not going to, this is a wonderful scene, so I'm not going to give too much away. But they decide that they need to have to be ready at every bridge and tunnel, because they assume he's going to Queens. He told the trooper he was going to Queens, and for other reasons, they think he's going to Queens. So they are literally ready at every tunnel to make sure that they can do a car search and make it look random and make it look like a random drug stop. It does not work that way. It looks anything but random, and he gets the bomb into the city. So I will leave that to the, but it was not the finest moment in counterterrorism.
And you can imagine the American counterterrorism community, which is enormous, which encompasses the national intelligence community, the CIA and everything, the FBI, New York Police Department, Colorado Police Department, the departments of everyone along the way are all screaming at each other, we got to stop this thing, we got to stop this thing. And just one more aside, back in Denver, what's going on?
Well, in Denver, once it comes back that, all right, he didn't have a bomb, right? And so he's going to, they become convinced, okay, he's not running to something, he's running from something. So whatever is happening is now happening in Denver. And as it happened, the ambassador to the United States from Pakistan, Ambassador Haqqani, just happens to be speaking in Denver with Governor Ritter at the time. At a time, and again, putting this in 2009, this is a time when the government of Pakistan is, you know, has stepped up its efforts, and is dealing with a lot of internal pushback, if you will, from whether it's the Taliban or whether it's sort of other militant groups, and you know there are threats on the president's life. So this idea that, oh my God, the Pakistan ambassador is in town, and we just had a guy just get the hell out of here. Maybe the plot is here. So they basically bring out the entire SWAT team of the CIA, of the NYPD, of the Colorado State Patrol, of the FBI, Denver Police, but they don't want to tip off anybody. So it's all these guys like snipers on rooftops, and they're all kind of just waiting for like something to happen, expecting that, you know, well, maybe the Denver Art Museum, which is where they were speaking, maybe that's what's going to blow up.
So as you can see, it's a great story, has many complex moving parts. But there's another very important part of this whole story, which is what happens after the fact, which is once Edward Snowden reveals the existence of NSA surveillance of American citizens, the National Security Agency, the Director of National Intelligence, and the Obama administration begins looking around for cases to prove the argument that NSA surveillance works. And if you'll remember the testimony that General Alexander gave, he said there were something like 50 cases or so of which it worked. But when pressed to give a single case where it worked, the NSA has repeatedly come back to the Zazi case and made the argument that this is the role model for why electronic surveillance works. And in the book, you give NSA the credit for being the ones who uncovered the plot. But I know that in subsequent publications, you've qualified that and said probably not these surveillance systems.
Yeah, I mean, you can't crack this case without being up on the email address. If you're not up on the Sana Pakhtani email address, you don't catch Najibul Azazi. And I believe, and I believe this based on however many hundreds of interviews we did, and obviously Azazi believed that had they not found that email, they would have blown up the subway. And so, right, that's give them their due. The flip side to that is they're not really being totally honest with us when they sort of hold this up as evidence that, you know, we need what I guess they call PRISM, and is really just the way, and I don't want to get too geeky here, but I mean, PRISM is really just the way that they execute their, you know, 702 authorities. And, you know, like anything else in America, we don't pay attention until it has a logo and a trademark name, right? I mean, so nobody knew what the hell 702 was. And then suddenly it was like, but we call it PRISM, and here's the logo. And everybody's like, now I'm paying attention. So in the end, yes, PRISM, the idea that because this company, Yahoo, is based in the United States, we are up on these Yahoo email addresses using PRISM. Yes, that's true. The flip side to that is they got that email address out of a case in the UK where they knew they were communicating with bad guys. And at that point, the standard for getting a pre-PRISM, pre-702, pre-any of this stuff, pre-FISA amendments, they would have been up on that email address anyways, because it was an Al-Qaeda address. You didn't even need to go to the judge. You could have flipped the switch, been up on the FISA, and then gone back to the judge later and said, oh, by the way, here's the reason we've been up on this email address. This would have been an instantaneous thing, even pre-PRISM. So, yes, it is a great example of PRISM, that PRISM caught this guy, but it in no way says this is why we need PRISM, because this isn't why... this isn't why there is, right? I mean, this isn't, PRISM isn't built for, 702 doesn't solve, let me take that back. 702 is, this is not the case that 702 and PRISM are necessary. There may be a case for that where, you know, I'm listening just like the public is listening, to hear what Alexander and others have to say, but it is a stretch to say that, you know, if not for 702, these guys would have blown up the subways.
But at the same time, you do, and just to repeat what you said at the beginning,
yeah.
You do give NSA the credit. And when you think about it, the whole post 9/11 homeland security system, starting overseas in Pakistan, starting with our liaison relationships, and then particularly with the city of New York with its own police department, none of those things had seen these three coming. NYPD has been described by some as the best intelligence service in the United States today. It is definitely a police department which has devoted more attention to the problem for understandable reasons. The good citizens of the great city of New York have an understandable reason to believe that their federal government hasn't done a particularly good job of protecting them over the last decade and a half. And NYPD has come up with a lot of programs to try to find exactly this kind of terrorist in the making. Can you give us the nutshell what NYPD
sure. So
does?
Sure. The cliff notes of the 9/11, the post 9/11 intelligence division is... Ray Kelly comes back to New York to be police commissioner and decides that, you know, I'm not going to sit around and wait for the FBI or CIA or whoever to tell me where the next plot is. I need my own intelligence. And I think that's we all agree, I think everybody agrees, we get that. So what he does is something unusual. He goes and he hires somebody by the name of Dave Cohen. And David Cohen was the former, he was retired at the time, deputy director of operations, basically the head of the clandestine service at the CIA, to come in and build an intelligence service at the NYPD. And what David did was he called down to Langley and asked George Tenet and said, you know, look, I need somebody active duty with a blue CIA badge who basically could be my right-hand man. And Tenet sends a guy named Larry Sanchez, who, again, active duty from the analytical ranks up to New York. And so he's got, you know, the blue CIA badge. He can start at the station in the morning, read everything, and then he goes to the NYPD and is directing domestic police department surveillance and collection. And so Dave and Larry came up with this idea. They looked at all of the dossiers and all the files that they had, that both the intelligence had and that media reporters had come up with about the 9/11 hijackers. And they found that, you know, Mohammed Atta was their signature case. And when they went through everything and they said, okay, there were a lot of moments. I mean, Mohammed Atta was not raised in a extremely religious household. There were moments along the spectrum, the transitions that he went through, where people noticed that reporters could then go and talk to people and say, yo, you know, I did notice, you know, that he grew a beard. I did notice that he shaved his beard. I did notice he became more strict in, you know, what his how he's going to live his life, about, you know, no drinking, and you know, there were all these moments. And they just said, if we, the NYPD, could become surrogates for all these people who saw little things, and we could line them up and connect the dots, maybe we'll catch the next Mohammed Atta, and if he's in New York. So they created this unit, and this is one of many units they created. They created this unit called the Demographics Unit. And they basically took a bunch of South Asian and Arab officers and they worked, you'd say undercover. The NYPD says they're not undercover, they're plainclothes, because they don't have like a fake name and a fake identity, so they're not undercover. And they just go and hang out all day. And they go and hang out in coffee shops or hookah bars or, reading rooms, or they'll go join cricket leagues, halal butchers, and they'll just hang out and talk. And they go through these steps where they say, you go in and you find out who's there, and you gauge their sentiment. What do they think about America? What do they think about American foreign policy? And you're putting that in files. So it'll, some of these reports you can read, they'll say, this is a Syrian sweet shop, seats 11 people, clientele is typically dressed in devout Muslim attire, the man at the counter's name is Muhammad, we strike up a conversation, he's upset, he doesn't like drone strikes, they're playing Al Jazeera, or they were watching the State of the Union, one of the ones we saw, two Pakistani men were watching the State of the Union address, and they were speaking about the State of the Union address in Urdu, and they were discussing American foreign policy, and that ends up in a police file. So the idea is that if we have everything, then we'll know where these hot spots are. And these plainclothes detectives became known as rakers, because the idea was if you rake the coals, you'll find the hot spots. And I won't get too far into it, but they built a lot of programs like this, and they were in Zazi's mosque. They had infiltrated Zazi's mosque. They had turned his imam into a cooperative. They had an undercover working there. They were in all the restaurants in his neighborhood. They had been to the YMCA where people, because they thought, well, maybe you would work out, because people had worked, done bodybuilding before carrying out an attack. They had been in the travel agency where Zazi bought his tickets. They were in the Muslim Student Association where one of the co-conspirators had studied. And at every turn, they built all these files on people, but they had nothing on the actual terrorists. When we look at counterterrorism programs, we want to take a critical eye, just like how did the bomb get past the guy in the bridge? How did the bombers get past the NYPD's programs? If this is what they're, this is when it mattered most. This is the case study for what these things were built to do.
Well, I should be clear, as I told you beforehand, my sympathies are very strongly with NYPD.
And while we have, I think we've taken some shots in New York as being anti-NYPD, far from the case. The vast majority of the people who spoke to us about the NYPD were from the NYPD, and we have these wonderful, relationships with these men and women, and they are, there's a character in the book who's a war hero who was running this demographics unit and, believed this was the absolute best way to keep America safe. And then he starts to get the expense report from his team, and he's like, why are you guys going to like this, pastry shop at like 4:30 p.m. and buying $40 of the pastry like right before you check out? Or like, hey, you keep going back to this one kebab house. Is there a problem there I should know? And they're like, well, no, it's just good food. If you serve good food in Queens, you may end up more likely to be in police files. So, we are not in any way anti-NYPD. We're pro successful counterterrorism. We're pro doing it doing it in a way that works and that protects everybody. And and we're for transparency.
I'm going to open it up to the audience in a minute. In the end, they confess, they break down, they're all in prison. Would the bomb have worked? We have reason to believe that they had put together a working device?
They had put together something that would blow up. This thing came down before they could finish the bomb. They had gone, Zazi had come to New York, and his plan was to buy the backpacks and assemble it there. They had a glass container of TATP. Now, I don't have any idea how you drive across the country at 90 miles an hour with that thing in your trunk. Testimony at trial came out that, you know, when they ultimately dumped it down the toilet, that, you know, one of the guys lit to try to get the residue off the bowl of the toilet. And so, I mean, something was there that was going to blow up. And he had made it several times. He'd done several test batches. I don't have any reason. The government says it was going to blow up. Zazi says it was going to blow up. Rashid Roof thought it was going to blow up. I mean, I'm inclined to give them the benefit of the doubt on that one.
I just ask you to all pause for a minute and think about it. It's September 2009. President Obama's been in office a little over a half a year. He's abolished torture. He's trying to close Guantanamo. We now know secretly he's stepping up the drone missions. But it would have been an extraordinary moment had three American citizens blown themselves up on the 9/11 anniversary in New York City. I think you can safely say the course of American history, and certainly the course of President Obama's presidency, would have been changed dramatically for the worse that morning. And there would have been a lot of calls by those on the other extreme to put more people in Guantanamo, do more domestic surveillance, spy on more people. So we are very fortunate indeed that this plot didn't succeed. Time to open up for questions from the audience. Please identify yourself, put your hand up. When we call on you, a microphone is coming. And please identify who you are briefly before asking your question.
Carter Kafer. So just amused that you said that the intelligence actually broke this thing. And, of course, the New York police have always taken credit for it. And they say, our unit is so effective that we did this. So this is the good sign that we found out there's more to it than the NYPD.
There's always more to it. I mean, look, let's remember the Joint Terrorism Task Force, which is sort of the clearinghouse for counterterrorism domestically in the United States. That is the one in New York is 125 NYPD detectives that are working hand in glove with the FBI. So in that regard, I mean, to the extent that there was, you know, really good law enforcement work done at the in New York City, which I think is objectively true, NYPD does get the credit. And when we hear that there's like turf wars between FBI and NYPD, it's not at the Joint Terrorism Task Force. It's the sort of intel guys that, you know, their stated goal, and this is not like, you know, I think the FBI has this belief that these guys are just jerks who want to do their own thing. They are by design this belief that, like, if we just fall in line with you, then we don't even need to exist. We don't need to have our own intelligence. If we all share information and we all sort of collaborate, that's just groupthink, and we need to do our own thing. And so when you hear about conflict, it's not with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, NYPD, it's with the other NYPD. So the great news is if Intel is successful, they can say, NYPD was successful. And if the Joint Terrorism Task Force was successful, they can say NYPD was successful. So, you know, as far as we're concerned, I mean, I don't really care who takes the credit. I just want to know, like, what worked.
Right here.
Rachel Levinson-Waldman with the Brennan Center. And I have two questions, but they're both pretty straightforward. One is that I'd love to know more about how you did the reporting, especially overseas, but generally kind of, you know, how you found your way into all the details of the story. And the second was following up on something you said before about the interaction between the discovery of the email address and PRISM. It hasn't sounded like there was really any connection between the two, but you said maybe it contributed but wasn't impaired. So I was just curious to hear a little bit.
So, I mean, from what we know of, I mean, we knew how the intercepted email ended up in American hands pretty clearly. And we were in final drafts of the book when the Snowden stuff came out. And so we were like, okay, pause. Does this change what we know? And in the end, it didn't change what we knew. All it did was give it a name. So all we had to do was say, comma, called PRISM, comma, and that was it. You know, the NSA has the authority through the Justice Department to go up on email addresses that bounce through the United States without specific warrants, right? I mean, you know this. And Prism is the mechanism by which the information that lives in these email addresses is transferred to the United States government. So that is the mechanism by which the email ended up in the United States government hands. Had it not been that pipeline, it just would have been the traditional FISA pipeline where the FBI says, hey, the Brits pulled a known terrorist email off of a hard drive. In this case, we're going to go up on it immediately. And it would just be that pipeline. In the end, I'm not a systems architect. It might be the exact same architect. There's probably somebody in the room who knows that. It may actually be the exact same wires. But the legal framework for it, all it is just a name. You give the NSA credit because they are vested with this authority and it worked. Our point is just you can't say that if not for this, you can say this program was successful here, but you cannot say that is why we need this program. It's the whole, if it hadn't been, there just would have been something else. It would have been the predecessor and that would have accomplished the same thing.
Do you want to say a few words about sourcing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we stumbled onto this story, the NYPD side of the story, through the CIA connection. We're reporting on that for the AP. But to us, it was nobody wants to read a polemic. Nobody wants to read sort of a policy. Well, some people want to read a policy book. You probably want to read a policy book. But we wanted to write a real narrative. And the Zazi case, which my colleague Adam Goldman and I both covered, provided us the opportunity to tell both stories and to take a look at policies when the ticking time bomb theory, the question of if there's a ticking time bomb in the city and you have a terrorist in custody, what are you willing to do, right? There is that moment in this book. And, I think we can ask ourselves questions now 12 years out in a more thoughtful and more, academic way than, we could have when, as a country, I think we were much more traumatized in 2002.
Amitai Etzioni, George Washington. I want to go back to this point about the difference between the legal authority and the wires, as you call them. As you implied, they're not the same. So the fact that you could have the legal authority to get there anyhow doesn't mean you would have the mechanism.
Well, they did have the mechanism. Pre-PRISM, pre-FISA amendments, the wires existed because the Justice Department and the FBI were getting FISA emails under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. They were getting those emails anyways. This was not one. This was not an email in a class where there was ever any doubt that this was a bad guy email. So there, in this case, the wire and the legal authority, both the technological capability and the legal authority existed well before 702 to get this email. Does that mean that's true for every email? Does that mean that, the NSA has no case to make? Does that mean? No. It just says that this case is a imperfect vehicle to say 702 and PRISM are necessary.
How much grief did you get from your liberal colleagues for saying, in the book, being more on the side of NSA and since then clarifying yourself?
I haven't gotten any grief from my colleagues. My colleagues have been really supportive of this book. We don't come down one way or the other on the sort of the political spectrum of the appropriateness of these programs. We come down on, well, what works? Here's the most serious. This was the next big thing. What worked? And, we tried to take an academic approach to it.
Well, just to clarify, if I can find my notes, the end of the book, they're clear. Zazi's plot failed because of good partnerships, good intelligence, and good luck. NSA officials intercepted the marriages ready email and passed it to the CIA, which shared it with the FBI. Before 9/11, there was no guarantee that would have happened. Again, as I said at the beginning, this is a success story. Intelligence actually worked, but I would say it worked by millimeters. It could have been disaster. More questions in the back?
Hi, my name is Hannah Salomon Schwartz. I'm a PhD student at George Washington. And my question is sort of picking up where we were a minute ago, that on the one hand, the system worked, on the one hand, and on the other hand, we were maybe a hair's breadth away from disaster. And I think in hearing your story and other stories that we've heard, there are two narratives about the successes of the intelligence community, and then also just how close we are to bad things. And my question for both of you is, to think about, both from the narrative perspective but also from the policy perspective, how to move a little bit farther away from the brink of disaster and to strengthen some of the successes that you saw in your narrative.
Well, the good news is, I had this, and this has shaped my thinking on all of this. I spent a long time in the reporting on this book with a woman who's an intelligence analyst in New York City, Washington, then New York City. And I had that question. Does it matter that it came close, right? Does it matter it came close? And she said, you know what? There was a lot of problems with this case, and it was imperfect, right? I mean, very rarely does it all work perfectly. She said, but you know what? I see the most sensitive intelligence in real time every single day. And I can tell you that on any single day, while the spectrum of badness that's out there is very real, the actual threat to New York or to Washington on any given day is infinitesimally small. That does not actually mean that there's not people out there wanting to do bad things, but that on any given day, the actual threat that you're going to be attacked in this country, you know, by Al-Qaeda, is infinitesimally small. And her point was that the way we view terrorism in the United States has not yet reflects that truth. So while this one came close, you know, that is not necessarily a reflection of the daily threat. And I'm using threat in the specific, not in the general. Threat as opposed to danger.
I would add just one thing to Hannah's question. One of the things that's striking to me about this case and Omar Farouk Abdulmutallab the Fort Hood killer, in all these cases, basically the bad guys offered themselves to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda didn't go out and do a survey of Afghan Americans looking for people who were disgruntled. They waited patiently for somebody to come to them, and then they invested a very small amount of effort in the project. Taught them how to build a bomb. In the case of Omar Farouk Abdulmutallab, didn't even teach them how to build a bomb, just taught them how to detonate a bomb. So from the standpoint of Al-Qaeda, it's fundamentally different than 9/11. 9/11, they invested years of effort, recruited people, sent them to the United States, kept them undercover with an elaborate plot. In these cases, basically they had walk-ins, as we call them in the intelligence community, who volunteered their services. And another striking fact, in both cases of Abdulmutallab, in this case, Al-Qaeda basically said to him, you pick the target. You know, we're not going to tell you what to do. You know what to do. You know where to blow yourself up. Abdulmutallab pissed Northwest 253 to Detroit on Christmas Day because it was the cheapest flight he could find out of Europe, which I'm sure I'm going to get bad feedback from Detroit over that, but it was the cheapest flight, and he could afford it. From a counterterrorism standpoint, this is a nightmare. The difference between the moment at which the terrorist determines his target to when he carries it out can be a few hours. In the case of these guys, it was a few days. Trying to foil a plot like that is a lot more difficult than foiling a plot like 9/11, which has a lot of moving parts and where there's a pretty good chance someone will make a mistake along the way. In this case, if he hadn't sent the message,
but you know, I guess I view it I view it a little bit differently. And I think one of the things, you know, we as a country still don't have a total handle on is the whole, like, what we're at war with. I mean, in the end, terrorism is a tactic,
right?
So what you are, we have declared, it's this equivalent of being like, we're at war with fist fighting, right? Like, it's a very hard thing to be at war with. So when you think about intelligence and you think about domestic intelligence, I guess I wonder, like, what the response would be if Newtown had been carried out by a guy who had been watching Anwar al-Awlaki videos, you know, as opposed to somebody who, you know, I mean, and look, I'm not, as somebody, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, I don't buy the, like, well, it's different because he's just crazy. A lot of these guys are crazy, right? I mean, you have to be a little bit crazy to do any of this stuff. So I think the question of, you know, well, it could have, it comes so close, why does it, you know, we don't have any indication that, you know, the guys who go up and shoot up movie theaters or go shoot up, you know, classrooms go through this long, drawn-out, you know, planning stage. So it's just as hard to spot those, but we respond very differently, right? I mean, if you walk in and you kill three people at a 7-Eleven in Boston and drive away with the money, they'll look for you. If you shoot up three people and scream Allahu Akbar, they might shut down the city, right? I mean, so we still don't know what we're really at war with, and these struggles of terrorism with a capital T, terrorism with a little lowercase T, domestic terrorism, international terrorism, crazy people with guns. It's blurry, and I think the more we talk about that, the better off we all are.
I couldn't agree more. We have a remarkable tolerance in this country for what we call gun violence. The minute you make it political, our tolerance drops down to zero. Let's take some more questions right here, sir.
Hi, I'm Stuart Taylor with Brookings. I have a question for Bruce. Given all we've heard from Matt about the extent to which the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of 702, not to mention the phone logs, programs figured in the Zazi success, could you look at both that and what you know about all the other evidence that's flying around and give your assessment of how effective these programs are in saving American lives?
Well, I'd love to, and a big reason why we invited Matt here is that the case hasn't been made. In fact, the argument that it worked is made more effectively in this book than it's ever been made by the American government in any of its testimony on the Hill. In fact, one of my critiques of the administration is its argument on the Hill involving this case has often not gotten the facts right. For example, they said they found knapsacks with bombs. Well, they didn't.
Wrong.
That kind of attention to detail is very, very important if you're trying to convince the American people and the American Congress that a program like this works. And I hope one of the things, my modest hope of this event and others like it, will be that we will see a more robust effort by the administration and the intelligence community to make their case now, particularly on that day, which we are all hoping comes sooner or later, when the government goes back to work and they can start having testimony on what we should do about the future of NSA surveillance operations. Let's hear the case made. I can't judge it right now.
Right.
If you say there are 50 cases where it worked.
Well, they changed that number now.
Right, they changed it all the time.
That number, so
give me, as a citizen, I think we need more transparency about how this program has worked in the past. And since I don't think we're really telling Al-Qaeda a big secret that we're monitoring their emails, I don't think that we're really giving away a lot of delicate sources and methods.
The one thing I guess I wanted to add, so government is a social contract. We decide that we're going to give the government the authority to tax us, to put us under surveillance, to wiretap us, to search our homes, to arrest us. We give them these authorities. When we pass laws, you know, we have a constitution that gives the government these authorities. And then in exchange, we know that we get safe streets, whatever, right? I mean, we get services for our taxes. It's a social contract. It goes both ways. We have some semblance of what we get back, and we know what we give up. And if it feels like, you know what, taxes are too high, or you know what, the police in our city are going too far, or we don't feel like we're getting enough back in return, we can change, you know, we can renegotiate the social contract as we go. The reason that I think, you know, what we write about with the NYPD and what's happening with the NSA right now is not necessarily that people really disagree with what's being done, although certainly some do. The bigger problem is the social contract doesn't work. If I don't know what you do, the government is taking, and I have no idea what I'm getting back. And that's the problem when you talk about domestic surveillance, is the social contract, we still have to have the social contract. You can't just throw that away in the name of, well, I'm keeping you safe, trust me. That's not what we're built on. So we have to find a way to get the social contract right on the issue of surveillance and security.
More questions? All the way in the back.
Thanks. Mike German with the ACLU. I'm a little concerned about the idea of presenting this as an intelligence success when, despite the fact that the NSA got the email, they got a bomb into New York City.
That's not an intelligence failure. That's a counterterrorism failure. And I do think it's important to make a distinction.
Okay, but we're leaving out one key fact, which is what stopped them was that they chickened out and flushed the bomb down the toilet rather than detonated it.
I don't know if you had a chance to read the book yet. I mean, what stopped them was the fact that they knew they were being followed in New York City by the FBI, and the reason they were being followed by the FBI is because they had the email. So they only chickened out because they were being followed, and the FBI was onto them. I'm not certainly not giving anybody a pass for how they got the bomb into New York City, but that's not intelligence.
But would you acknowledge that they could have detonated the bomb in the apartment building, in the car on the way?
Absolutely, but I think that's not an intelligence failure. I want to make a distinction. That wasn't a failure that they didn't know this guy was a bad guy. That's a counterterrorism failure, and I do think that's different. And I don't want to conflate those.
Okay.
I mean, a guy gets a bomb past a checkpoint is not an intelligence failure. It's just not. I mean, am I wrong on that?
Right. Okay. Into the underwear bomber is an example of an intelligence failure and a counterterrorism failure. We didn't know anything about this guy, and all the elaborate electronic sniffing devices in the world. He was moving from airport to airport with it. We can speculate that maybe it spent so much time on him that it degraded itself during the way. But that's a case, I would say, of intelligence failure and counterterrorism failure, and I agree with Matt. In this case, the intelligence system worked. It not only told us the bomb was coming, it gave us the identity of the bomber. The failure to keep it from getting into the borough.
And it was a failure. I mean, let's be honest.
It was a failure. Yeah.
They said the only thing we care about is the bomb doesn't get into New York City, and it did. Failure. I mean, I'm not in any. In fact, I'm not getting into it because I think it's such an interesting moment. I want everybody to go buy the book and experience how they got the bomb in the city. So, but I'm not giving them a pass. But I also just don't want to confuse the issue, which I think the two important issues.
More questions in the back.
Hi, I'm Norma May Isico from Wake Forest University. I wondered a question to both of you. What do you think of the way in which Edward Snowden made his revelations and how it affects you, Matt, as an investigative journalist, and you, Bruce, as a director of intelligence?
It affects me as an investigative journalist that I have a lot more information about the NSA. It hasn't affected me in terms of, you know, my ability to do my job. I mean, there are other, I mean, I think there's a lot going on right now with the administration and their issue of going after people who are not authorized. You know, there's sort of two tiers of people who can talk to reporters. There's three tiers. There are the people who are paid to talk to reporters, the people who are told to talk to reporters, and the people who are, if not gotten approval to talk to reporters. We're totally fine with people giving out classified information, you know, in that second tier. We are less cool with it on that third tier. I think that makes it harder. Snowden has given, I think the president has said Snowden has started a conversation that I think is an important one for us to have. You know, smarter people than I can debate, and people with arrest authority and extradition authority can debate the legality of the charging and all that stuff. From an information gathering standpoint, certainly we have a lot more information about what our government does objectively.
As a former intelligence officer, my feeling is pretty simple. He violated the oath that he swore to his country. He was given access to classified information. When you do that, you sign a little piece of paper that says, I will never, ever, ever give classified information away under penalty of prison and penalty of fine, and he knowingly and wittingly has done that. So in that sense, I don't see him as a hero of any kind. He violated the law. He violated the agreement he signed. What amazes me about Mr. Snowden is the access that he seems to have had. For a contractor, he seemed to have been given access to the mother load of intelligence documents in the United States. I spent 30 years in the CIA. I never saw the budget. I can recall being shown one page of the budget once. This guy had the whole budget. In addition to investigating his background, I think we need a thorough and complete investigation of how a contractor was able to get access to so much information and then spirit it out of top secret facilities. There is something profoundly wrong in the contracting world in the intelligence community today that somebody of this stature could get access to this much material. And I'm much more concerned about that. You know, Mr. Snowden can spend the rest of his life in Russia. I'm sure he's going to find it's a lovely place. I want to make sure that the intelligence community does a much better job of making sure that future leakers are not in a position to just download the mother load anytime they feel like it.
The first is, yes, everybody signs this thing saying we won't give up classified information. But there appears to be a difference in the city from when, you know, CIA current on the book CIA guys get driven to Bob Woodward's house to give an interview for the latest book. That's still classified information, right? But we make a difference in that city. And that's what I was getting at. The second thing is, people say somebody of that stature, oh my, he's a 20-year-old guy. The truth is, who else do you think is going to be able to figure out the computer systems but the 28-year-old guy? Right. I mean, it's not like we were like, oh man, and Mike Hayden was the one who figured out how to hack into all the systems. I mean, of course it was a 28-year-old guy. And the last thing on that is, the last thing on this idea of like, well, how is he able to do this? The reason we should care is not just because this, I mean, and frankly, not even mostly because it has our nation's secrets in it. Because these protections that he was able to get around are the ones they're telling you, this is why you don't need to worry about the fact we have all your stuff. Because we got all these protections. But yet he's able to walk out with all the stuff they're protecting just as much. So if they can't protect the budget and they can't protect the FISA orders and they can't protect these PowerPoints, we should be asking questions about, well, how do I know my emails and my phone records are in a good way? You know, what about the contract? You know, we have a contractor here who clearly either saw that he thought surveillance had gone too far. What about a contractor who thinks, you know, adultery or pornography has gone too far, right? I mean, how secure is your stuff? How secure is your emails, with the person you're dating, right? I mean, with your viewing habits online, how secure is that if this stuff isn't secure? And those are the questions I want to answer.
We have a few more minutes, 10 minutes left. Let's take a bunch of questions and then wrap it all up with those. In the back with the folder in the air.
Thank you, sir. I am Suleri. I am from the Embassy of Pakistan. Just a comment first, and I'll go ahead with the question. The comment is that I think it also, the book also needs to be seen in the perspective of 2008 and 9 when they landed in Pakistan. A person who had lived in Pakistan as an Afghan refugee, had his wife there, and was going and meeting his parents. So his family. So when he was traveling, he must have been checked out at 1,000 places because I was there in that time. And we were checked at every place. There were bombings going on even in the capital city.
Exactly.
With bomb blowing off in Marriott, a big bomb blowing off at Marriott as well. So definitely having a kiosk for the Al-Qaeda at the airport is not a good idea. It was not popular then, would not be ever popular in Pakistan. Since then, the army had moved in. And now over about 158,000 troops are there, one-third of the Pak army. We have lost more than 50,000 Pakistani people and more than 5,000 troops in this battle. But I'm sure it's not that easy to move on in that area. But
no, and I think, or at least I tried to make it clear, their stories checked out. There was no indication that, you know, that there was anything suspicious about these guys going to Pakistan. Of course, they had family there. And you know, there have been other people. There are other people we write about in the book who have been turned away at the airport in Pakistan. Shahada is a good example. We were turned away in collaboration between you know, the ISI and CIA and FBI, been able to turn people back. So yeah, I certainly want to make that clear. There's nothing suggesting that these guys had, you know, an in. And frankly, that to me is what was most interesting about it, right?
Thank you, sir. The question was, you mentioned also, why did Zazi, you know, he moved from here thinking that he would be fighting the troops on ground, but he, in the end, changed his mind to come back to the U.S. and go for the suicide bombing. What changed the mind that you mentioned was the drone attacks that took place at that time.
Yeah.
You know, while the drone attacks, so to say, have been, you know, also to pick up the to hit the primary targets over there and has been very effective, so to say, in killing the people. But you show yourself when you say that he was at that time affected by the drone attacks at that moment. Do you still think that it was have a counterproductive role in changing the mind of the people?
I think there's a difference between saying it's counterproductive, which I didn't say. Did not say drones are counterproductive. I just said there are unforeseen consequences to any. I mean, there are consequences to any policy. You clearly have people who, and we've seen. Zazi's not the only one who have taken up this issue of drone strikes as their, you know, as their banner. A very good friend and a very smart, longtime counterterrorism analyst. And I don't take this as fact, but I take this as good insight. Said, you know, I've looked at every single terrorist plot against the United States that has been uncovered, and the only consistent on the radicalization, the only consistent is at some point they become convinced that the United States is at war with Islam, and I think that is important. I don't know if that's true across the board. He said it was, but I do think it's important that we understand what some of these triggers are. I'm not saying drones are counterproductive, but clearly there are instances of people like Zazi who are influenced by drones to take up arms against the United States.
More questions?
Hi, my name is Ashwarya. I'm a sophomore at Wake Forest University. And this is kind of a general overview question. But do you see potential in the NSA's surveillance programs to uncover incidences of, like, human trafficking, drug trafficking, or is it limited just to terrorism? And a kind of second part question to that would be, has the NSA done anything about when they, if at all, uncovered incidences of sexual abuse or domestic violence while tailing an incident of terrorism or something like that?
It's a great question, and you know, feel free to jump in. My observation is, so these programs are tailored by statute for national security and terrorism. So you're not supposed to use, your 702 authority, you know, or your 215 authority to go to build files on people for non-terrorism, non-national security purposes. One of the big things, I was just talking with this about this with another reporter the other day. One of the big things is going to be as the global sort of Islamic terrorism threat, when that ebbs, at some point every threat ebbs, right? When that ebbs, are they going to shut the machinery off, right? When that stops being the kind of, you know, the existential threat that we see it as, will they shut the machinery off? Or will they just be like, well, let's use it for something different? And that's a very important thing we should watch for as a citizenry is, you know, we've given them authority to have these programs for one reason. You do start to see, and we write about it in the book, you know, is, you know, fusion centers that are there to build intelligence for terrorism, but stat, you know, by statute they sort of broaden it and they were like, and all other law enforcement purposes. So I do think that's something we should be concerned about and paying attention to, both as journalists and as citizens.
Two more questions to wrap it up. All the way in the back.
Thank you. My name is Mohammed Ahmed. I work for Council on American Islamic Relations. And I want to pick from your question is about the trust that the contractor, you feel that the government contractors violate by leaking certain information out. And my question for you, how far that contractor or that individual or the government employee shall continue not leaking certain information when he feels that it's been compromised? And for example, like we saw in Abu Ghraib, for example, we saw a torture. We saw so many things in Quetta, in so many places in with the intelligence committee and even within the United States. So within our country here, we saw this massive violations as an individual who working for the government or you are part of the system. How far you have to be quiet?
Good. Let's take one more question. Surely there's one other person with a question. Right here in front.
I was wondering if Zazi's family expressed any kind of concerns prior to him as he was developing his plot and plan. It seems like that going from New York to Denver, patterns of behavior that may have caused his family maybe some concern. I was wondering.
Sure. So his uncle and aunt lived in Aurora already. So it wasn't like a huge stretch to be like, I'm going to go out there and live. And it was pitched inside the family as, go see how Aurora is, and if you can get a job there, and if you can do, and then maybe his parents and his, you know, his siblings would follow. And they ultimately did follow, you know, a few months behind. They were able to get, he was able to get work as a limo driver. When he was living with his aunt and uncle, there was a moment when he was in the garage futzing around with these chemicals, and his uncle walked in and was like, what the hell is this? And, you know, Zazi had some cockamamie story, and uncle wasn't buying it, but wasn't sure, like, what the heck was going on. And they told him, ultimately, you got to just get rid of all this stuff, flush it out. I mean, it was like bleach. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, you walk in and it's like dynamite in there. I mean, it was like household stuff. Should he have turned in Zazi at that point? I don't know. I mean, he didn't. The uncle didn't even tell the father, and just said, "We don't want this stuff in the house." You know, I don't know what you're doing, but I don't want it in the house. So there were signs, but again, it wasn't necessarily there weren't necessarily a ton of signs that he was going to launch an attack. You know, and a lot of people who knew him describe him as a pretty nice kid. You know, I mean, he wasn't somebody who's out, you know, railing against, you know, the government or, you know, so.
I'll just make a very brief comment. There's all kinds of gray areas here. There's no evidence in Snowden's case that at any point he ever went to his management style and said, you know, I have problems with what's going on here. I think we should, or that he went to his senator or his congressman. He pretty much made a decision all on his own. I think that is a violation of the oath he had. It's a violation of his commitments to his partners. That doesn't mean, though, as Matt has wisely told us, that President Obama isn't right. It has started a national conversation about this. I think the president has also this year tried to start a national conversation about how we put the counterterrorism war on a long-term footing. And my own view is there's no end in sight. I've argued in other places we're actually facing the third generation of Al-Qaeda, and it may be a long, long haul ahead of us. I think one of the virtues of this book and looking into the Snowden case and others is we're going to be this in for a long haul. Let's make sure we understand what our government is doing. Let's look at what works. Let's look at what doesn't work. And let's try to deal with the problem we're going to face for the foreseeable future, not in a sense of panic, but in a sense of understanding the enemy, understanding what works, and hopefully coming up with systems that, as you say, the social contract with the American people is reinforced rather than undermined.
And can I, on the Snowden thing, on the issue of like going to your congressman, I will say one of the more revelatory moments for me in watching the Snowden stuff play out is, you know, people in Congress saying, this was never what we intended. You know, we didn't know this. We didn't know this. At the same time that the executive is saying these guys are totally briefed. So you can see why Snowden would think, why am I going to go to Congress on this, right? I mean, so, you know, again, people can debate the idea of whistleblower versus criminal. You can be both. But I do think, it, as Bruce says, there are gray areas here. I mean, this is not, you know, this isn't black and white.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for giving us your insights into the book.
Listening to the Lawfare Podcast, produced in collaboration with the Brookings Institution. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.